Hello all, welcome to the God Said of Us podcast. This is Patrick Barney. I'm one of the editors of Kai Draconis Books. Kai Draconis Books is an independent anarchist press that publishes socially engaged literature. With me, as always, are the other two editors of Kai Draconis Books, Chris Malmberg and Hans Berger. And today we are going to discuss a wonky novel called The Vorr, V-O-R-R-H, by Brian Catling. It was your pick, Chris, so I'm going to hand it straight off to you. I have no idea where to start. You know, it's all up to you.
I think a summary might be a bad idea, for this. So,
right.
I think that maybe some stabs. I know that we agreed to write these down and I didn't because I started painting my bathroom and then I forgot. And so I apologize. This is going to be me winging it after we agreed to write them down ahead of time. So that's my fault. But basically, this is a book full of really like different intersecting fictional characters and that are completely made up and historical figures that are, definitely sort of, not written true to life, but like sort of, Catling is taking some of their legacy and playing with it in this story. And the story is set, mostly in a European city, that is sort of built on the edge of the heart of Africa. I don't know if you could sort of nail down where in Africa this is supposed to be, but it is playing with this idea of colonialism around the turn of the 20th century, and a bunch of different sort of dramas and very weird pseudoscience and folklore and like myth making and fantasy all sort of spiraling out from this magical unknowable place called the Vorr, which is the heart of this, you know, some, you know, like it's kind of written about in a way that's not like that doesn't really convey a good sense of like physicality necessarily or of like where it is again in Africa, but it's like the white whale in Moby Dick. It's, you know, it's the unknowable, impenetrable, you know, sort of like permanence that like mankind can never penetrate. And, this sort of European city is like pressing against it, and the pressure, this colonialist pressure against this ancient, inhuman, space is sort of like the setting for a bunch of different, stories about a bunch of different characters that are all, very, melodramatic and strange. We have, a cyclops who has been created, grown, and sort of tutored through into young adulthood by first a group of robots made of bakelite, like the early plastic, and then his tutelage is taken over by a very, very precocious young lady. And then they start to bone and everything goes sideways. He then cures a woman's blindness by having sex with her, ventures into the Vorr. We have a man, who is venturing into the Vorr, chased by various people trying to stop him for very mysterious reasons. He's, walking through the Vorr with a bow made from his dead partner's body. And he'll shoot it into the distance and then kind of walk to the arrow, I guess, and then just sort of keep doing that. And he's attacked and fights back. We have a kind of this idea of workers who are sort of slaves, but they're technically no longer slaves, but they have basically been absorbed by the work they do on the edge of the Vor, and they're conscripted by these colonialist sort of masters to sort of continuously work on what we, I guess, understand to be like an impossible task of just sort of pulling resources from the Vor and sort of expanding into the Vor. And they are sort of a hive mind. And it is discovered that stillborn children brought to them upon being born dead will never degrade. They won't like rot. And so, and then a mistake is made when an aborted child's brought to them, and that sort of produces this kind of demonic thread of the story, and all of these things. I mean, I don't know if they ever really like culminate into an understanding of what's going on or like a suitable climax, but everything inside of that, and I hope I'm doing an okay job of conveying sort of like the experience of the book. It's to me, it's more about experiencing the, all of these interlaced, really bizarre stories, arc within a frame of, Hans, how you mentioned something about how like the frame made you sort of want to like the book when you first read it. And I wonder if that's like a place to start, because I, the second time I read it, I don't know if I know what to do with the frame at all now. Do you have anything to add to what I talked about at the center of the book? And do you have like a place we could start with the frame, or do we want to ignore the frame?
Even though it sounds like I said something about the frame before, I'm not totally sure what you mean by that now. Can you clarify what you mean by the frame?
Well, I guess like the start of the book. I guess it's not really a frame. It's like the writer at the beginning that we... Is that meant to be...
Oh, I forgot about that. So the start of the book is Max Kinder in the hotel room, who's referred to as the Frenchman, I think, everywhere else, right? I don't think that name is used again. So there's we begin with the Frenchman in the hotel room, a.k.a. Max, and he's having sort of a crisis moment. And then I'm not totally sure where that is. I think that is chronologically before most of what happens in the book. And then the end of the book is Max Kinder has become sort of this underground cult literary icon. And it's Belgium in the 60s. And his assistant, Charlotte, is meeting someone who... is a latter day acolyte of his work. Is that what you mean by the frame? Is the way that it begins and ends on this kind of debauched literary figure?
Yeah, I thought that the prologue was Kinder later in life, like the 60s returned to him, like the first.
Well, I think he's dead in 1961, right? Like he's dead at the end.
Okay, yeah.
And at the beginning, there's a reference to him not being sure if Charlotte keeps the books appropriately, which suggests that he has Charlotte working for him as an assistant. I glanced back at it just now and pulled those details. So that's why I'm thinking, I mean, it might be that the prologue happens a little bit later than the main action, but not much, I don't think.
Like the end of the prologue, then he realized it was time to die and he did. Like this is like Max Kinder after the sort of like the meat of the novel, And then we go back to, I apologize, I threw it to you because I didn't really know what to do with Max Kinder, I guess, like as sort of this, you know, something that, and he's supposed to have written a book about Africa that is, because he's one of these historical figures that have been fictionalized for this book. Is that meant to be kind of a thread that I thought he was?
I just Googled him just now. And I mean, there are a lot of other Max Kinders who are like Olympic athletes and stuff. So maybe I missed one. Max Kinder writer. Maybe he was. Because there's Max Kinder.
Raymond Roussel.
Yeah, yeah. Max Kinder, I don't think really existed. Raymond Roussel, I think, was real. Thomas Muybridge definitely was.
Thomas Muybridge, Goal was real. And I was reading about his contributions actually to discovering anorexia nervosa. Mm. Why did I think that Max Kinder was the guy who wrote Impressions?
Well,
of
he
Africa.
Does, because it says in the coda, it says that he wrote Impressions of Africa, right? Is Impressions of Africa a real book?
Yes, written by Raymond Roussel.
Okay, so I misunderstood that reference in the coda then. Okay.
Okay, I should have written something down.
No, it's fine. I mean, I think that this kind of, you could have done a lot more prep work than you did, and we would still kind of be dazed by some of this stuff, right? I mean, it's not a book that I think is necessarily interested in carefully locating you in any kind of precision, right? And
yeah,
one thing that you mentioned when we were briefly chatting about this beforehand that I think does, I might be able to tie this back a little bit to Max Kinder, even though this is mostly extra textual stuff, right? But you asked maybe a week ago, why was this book so popular, right? Because relative to the, I don't even know that I want to call it dense necessarily. It just kind of feels intuitive, maybe.
Shaggy.
Yeah, shaggy.
Intuitive.
Right? It feels like it was put together in a very intuitive way by somebody who had, like, his artistic imperative kept him from going back. It doesn't feel edited necessarily, or it feels edited at a line level and then totally unedited at a major structural level. And I might be wrong about that. I wasn't able to find much about his process. But you asked the question of why is this popular, which it was relative to its accessibility. And I think, I mean, the answer that, as far as I can tell, the reason that it was popular is because it did a really good job from a marketing standpoint of straddling a fantasy audience and a litfic audience, right? It did a good job of presenting itself to both those audiences as something that they could get into. Every now and again, you have books that do this, right? Like, I remember when The Passage by Justin Cronin came out, it was this, you know, literary, very obscure literary fiction novelist who kind of thought, well, fuck it, I'm tired of being ignored, I'm going to write about zombies. And everybody kind of went, ooh, it's a horror novel and a litfic novel. And they're, you know, briefly, like, that was going to be the wave of the future, and then that didn't really happen. And I think this did kind of a similar thing where it has all these kind of, like, it signals literary pretensions very early on, I think partly by having Max as a character and just generally through the way that it's kind of written and presented. And it has, you know, these kinds of blurbs on the back from people like Tom Waits and Jeff Vandermeer that also do a pretty good job of kind of straddling those worlds or straddling those appeals. But I mean, it, you know, is generally regarded and presented as a fantasy novel, right? And I think the character of Max kind of does some work to set that tone.
And I guess that I'm kind of, I opened up the Raymond Roussel Wikipedia, and basically impressions of Africa is, it sounds like a kind of a model for what also a sort of a model or lens for focusing what Kettling is doing here, which is a carnivalesque, all over the place, very surreal, just mess that was incredibly unpopular when it was written and later elevated Roussel to a kind of cult status after he had passed. But Patrick, you didn't like this book.
No, I would say like it has all the horrible things that I hated about Against the Day with none of the good things that I liked about Against the Day. Like a ton of characters, no narrative drive, like no real story. I mean, hell, Against the Day at least has like a real narrative through line. You know, as much as it veers away from it, like I you don't know anybody's motivations. You don't know anybody's reasons for doing anything. You don't
except for having sex. The reasons for having sex are very, very clear.
Yeah, I mean, self-evident, but also like you don't even understand like it's something that fantasy literature is definitely supposed to do. But which this does not do is tell us the rules of the world. You know, like in this world, you can, you know, make a conscious bow out of your dead partner's remains. You can cure blindness by having sex with someone. There are, you know, cyclopean monsters without heads called anthropophagi, you know, as described by Heraclitus or someone in his true history of the world or whatever. You know, so like I'd say on that level it's super bad. Like it doesn't you know.
Why does it need rules though? I think that one of the reasons that I'm partial to it is that it doesn't try to explain what but is that
because it's an incomprehensible experience otherwise. Like, you know, okay, so you like that. That's fine. But I would say that it is a negative thing when it makes for an incomprehensible experience. But also, like, and I have to pull up my source here. I read this article called Lost in the Vor by James Williams on this site called Pop Matters. And he points out that, like, even on the level of, like, this hallucinatory phantasmagoria that I imagine a lot of people like about this novel, he points out that even on this level, it doesn't really work. So I'm just going to read his example. So let me find it. So these are his words. Given its abstruseness, unconventional plotting, and plotting pace, much of the appeal of the Vor will depend on the more immediate rewards it offers as a page-by-page experiences, by a page-by-page experience. Responses are unlikely to be ambivalent. For some readers, the prose will be entrancing. For others, it will simply foreclose the possibility of immersion in the novel, whatever its other merits may be. And so he says, it's fair to describe some of the writing as verbose and inexact, but often inopaque and bordering on meaninglessness. So let's, and here's an example. He has like four or five. I'll just look at one. And this is the author quoting from the Vor. Old weapons, clothing, gods, and kitchen tools were stacked inside to be sent away, shabby totems of a discarnate history expelled. So now we're back to the author's words. Since discarnate means not having a physical body, it would seem that the history that is being expelled here is precisely incarnate because it is constituted of material things. One has the impression that the author simply likes the sound of the word discarnate, especially in proximity to expelled, which allows for a couple of clicking K sounds to suggest a brief rhythm. So, yeah, like, I think on the sentence, you know, it's interesting, Hans, that you said, like, it seems like it's edited on the sentence level, but nowhere else. And, like, I think on the sentence level, it's ultra shitty, too. So, you know.
Well, I think, I guess, like, I...
Just to defend my own comment there, I mean, it can be labored over at the sentence level without necessarily being, you know, I mean, the quote that you read made probably the accurate point that maybe like the word discarnate doesn't totally make sense there, but it has kind of the smell and the feel of great writing, even if you can kind of pull it apart and suggest that it's hollow from a content standpoint. But that doesn't mean that it didn't take a decent right. amount of work to create that effect,
no,
regardless
you're
of the
right.
essential
sure.
acuity of it.
Sure, sure, sure.
And I guess that's like, I'm curious about like where this, so when I first read it, I think like I have the physical copy of the book and I have the audiobook, and the audiobook, I don't remember the narrator's name, but he does a very lively job of just sort of like reading these lines, and they're kind of a pleasure to listen to.
And no, I remember that.
Yeah, and I remember
the audiobook was good.
He was great. And I remember, I think he's an actor, like one of those that guys that you see in the corner of movies every now and then. But
right.
And I remember being really kind of fond and mystified by it in a way that like that sort of in, I was like, hey, maybe there's something there. But mostly I was curious about like the sentence level stuff. And I got the physical copy. And when it came time for me to choose a book, I thought like, hey, you know, this was kind of like a mystery to me listening to it. And I kind of liked the experience. And also it seemed in my memory, like there was a, like maybe it had done a little bit of work as far as like sort of addressing like issues of colonialism and slavery. And now upon reading it again, I don't have the sense that like those are actually being done. Like nothing's being meaningful is being done with those yeah. topics. Like we have a lot of set pieces that are sort of interesting for evaluating it. And then we have actually kind of like these gestures toward very, seemingly very kind of sincere, interesting, like investigations. There's a character, Singali, who has basically played both sides of this, you know, colonialism and anti-colonialist like position. And now is, you know, kind of doing his own thing as a merc body, not bounty hunter, assassin.
Right.
And he's interesting. The idea of slaves becoming a slave to work is interesting. And then nothing really comes of that. And so I guess like my question about like its popularity, maybe a more pointed question that may be more interesting to us, because I did come away reading this the second time pretty glazed. I think like I got through to I think it was like with the Scottish MacLeish and his experience with the Limboya, you know, create, you know, kind of like taking those stillborn fetuses to the Limboya and the Limboya performing some sort of ritual, where a couple things happened at once for me. One, I realized this was a white guy writing about like colonialist issues in, you know, a time to which he doesn't belong, and sort of maybe playing very sloppily with like rituals and mythologies and folklore and, you know, like things that might come from a very, very sloppy understanding of like real people's mythologies and cultures and rituals and folklores. And that made me profoundly uncomfortable. And it felt, and like, there's this kind of line there where like the Limboya, you know, like we're made to understand that they're not just black people. Like there's Scottish people there. There's, you know, people from all over the world. And it felt like really suddenly I felt like I could see where like there was nowhere that he was going to take it that was interesting or sort of addressing the questions that I had, you know, listening to it more closely now instead of just sort of enjoying the sound of this narrator's voice. And I kind of listened to it and read it, which I think probably added to my confusion. I had the physical book and the audiobook and I traded between the two of them. And at reading it, the lines were far less compelling. But I guess like the more pointed question I have, rather than like, why is this book popular, is where in like the application of craft, like if we say that like this book in as an idea is not, it's not a bad idea, right? Like there's some pieces here that are good. Where does this book fall short in terms of craft? Because I do agree, and I'm not going to defend this book.
Okay.
Even though I suggested it.
So just to like jump on that, cause I think that's a super interesting question. Like, so there is an art form that exists that uses words and it doesn't rely on narrative and it still functions. And that's called poetry. And poetry is awesome, right? Like, you know, not some poetry is narrative, blah, blah, blah. But like there are great poems that show that you don't necessarily need a narrative to function. You can function on just vibrancy of language. But the best of those also have meaning content. So I think, like, as we already pointed out, like the line level stuff often is missing meaning content. So I think that's a big deal. So I think what you have is a combination of a lack of narrative with vibrant but empty language. And these two things, like, you just can't put both of those two things together. Like, you know, Against the Day, like, it may not have been my favorite book, but like the language, like what the guy is saying, it has meaning content, you know. And even the different threads of stories make sense, like in their own, in and of themselves. So I'd say those are the two main things. And like, you obviously can't like explore any thematic subject without having meaning content either, right? So like that seems to be one reason why it would fall short on theme wise. And also, like, just to kind of finalize my thoughts here, I think like it is also, I think, exactly like you said, like a white guy far removed from his subject, the subject itself and the time, trying to represent these things. And so you end up with a character like Sungali, who's kind of interesting, but also in other ways, like, uncomfortably stereotypical, if that makes sense. And, like, yeah, so, yeah, I just think this book is just bad. It's just bad all around. This is not a good book. It's a total failure.
I mean, this came out in 2015, right? And I think that it was very lucky that it came out right when it did. I suspect that if it had come out a few years later, certainly if it came out now, it probably would have come in for a lot more criticism around issues of race and representation, right? I don't find it personally offensive, but I certainly don't find it effective thematically on those on those terms.
Right.
And I don't think that it would have, I don't think it would have been nearly as adored as it was if it had come out a few years later for those reasons. And like you, Patrick, I mean, I think that it's a lot of the sentences are surprisingly meaningless, though to be fair, right? Like, you know, there is some stuff you can open it. You can open it and find a random sentence that's pretty well written and that is meaningful, right?
I'm sure you can.
It's not like, I mean, you can certainly take sentences and pick them apart, but there are lots of sentences that are great. There are lots of sentences that are fine at vividly describing the thing being observed in an interesting way where the internal metaphors do make sense. But I mean, I do think that it...
Fair enough.
I don't think that it's interested actually in theme, really. Right. Like it has a couple little gestures at theme. And, you know, the first 15 pages or so have some pretty strong white people are bad kind of stuff from the perspective of a colonial subject. But it abandons that almost immediately. Right. I mean, it seems like it's interested in that setting more for mood and vibe and color than for anything particularly. It just doesn't seem like it's interested in making a moral statement or a historical statement on those topics or any topic, really, right? And we keep coming back to Against the Day. I mean, I think that's one place where it's very different from Against the Day. You know, Against the Day is an enormously thematic and very, very morally weighted book. I do think that one defense that I made of Against the Day when we talked about it was that its narrative fracture is, you can read that as being an extension of the anarchist ideals that it espouses, right?
Right.
And I suppose if you wanted to make a corresponding defense here, you could say that, you know, the book is named after this kind of the Vor itself is kind of this place of the decay of meaning and narrative and it kind of madness, and that maybe the structure of the book where it has all these kinds of the complexity of the book maybe is meant to mimic that or kind of signal the experience of being in the Vor. But I don't know that that's particularly effective as a defense, right? Like, if anything, I feel like it, even though, like, I mean, it's a little bit chaotic, it's a little arguably over complex, but it's not that bad, really. It's not that hard to follow, you know? I mean, it doesn't have, for being 500 pages long, I'm not sure that it has that many characters and threads necessarily, and most people's stories do come to some kind of definable conclusion, right? It's really not. I think that if those narrative threads in it had more structure and drive, I think you could have as much stuff in it as you do and still have it be effective. It's just that, like, for the most part, people just kind of do stuff, you know. You mentioned motive, and motive is often kind of fuzzy, kind of unclear, right? People just kind of do things and things just kind of happen. And, you know, you come to things that have the feeling of a conclusion, but where there's not necessarily anything that's been learned, and there's not really not much in the way of explanation and not much in the way of a sense that, you know, the character has... For the most part, it doesn't really seem like the characters grow or change in any particularly meaningful way. But it's not that absence, you know, sometimes you might have a work where the characters are static, or where they, you know, where that can be meaningful, that can be thematic if it's conscious. But, you know, it like I said before, there's a sense that the at everything above a sentence level, ultimately, this feels like a very intuitive, unconsidered work, right? And the way that characterization works is another outcome of that.
Is this like if you take poetry, like some of the things that work for poetry, Patrick, because Catling is a poet first, and then this is his first novel. Does that sort of like, is that something, is that kind of betraying a kind of, not a weakness in poetry, but something in poetry that doesn't have to be considered when, but becomes evident when you stretch something out for 500 pages?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like, I think that, you know, there he's doing a bunch of stuff that might work in poetry, that's just not gonna work for, you know, like, how can you pay attention to just 500 pages of like drivel, man? You know, like, you can't do it. Like, and the longer a poem in it, the longer a poem is, the more likely it's a freaking narrative poem. You know, the Iliad, the Odyssey, these are long poems. They're you know, and other things, but like, you, and I know, Hans, you said like it's not that hard to follow, but for me, lacking character motivation, and like any, like, without a sense of why a character is doing what he's doing, or, you know, yeah, basically without a sense of why a character is doing what he's doing, like, my reaction is always like, I can't follow this. So I don't know, maybe it's just a difference in reading, but I definitely found this, like, I see what you're saying, how you can like describe a, like, the things that the characters do, but like, as an experience, that's after the fact, right? Like, describing what they do in the experience of reading or listening to it, without having that motivation, I'm unable to connect A to B. So I don't know. I felt like I had another point, but I forget what it was. Like, who cares? Even,
I think, going back to Against the Day is a reason why I kind of picked this book, because,
oh yeah,
yeah, I'm really fascinated with this time, like, turn of the 20th century, like right around the 1900s. I think with this sort of, steampunk comes up with the Vore, and I'm not very into steampunk, but I think steampunk is like a vector into something which I find fascinating, which is this idea of the endless possibility of science and technology, that, and the way that sort of intersects with ancient mythology and like the unknown at that point in time, where like we have this flash where the like empirical method and the progress of technology and man's ascendance, you know, like as a technological, like as a being that uses technology, is sort of limitless. Like this the idea of people landing on the moon, you know, just, you know, around the corner or whatever, and like the beginning of science fiction, and sort of a kind of naivete of science fiction, where like there isn't the clear delineation between science fiction and reality that we developed over the following century. Mm-hmm. And also the naive cultural pluralism of the time, where it's like, wow, you know, like all these different people believe all these different things, and, you know, maybe there is, you know, this mythical being, and, you know, or maybe this is the Chinese medicine is real, you know, like, which was, you know, Orientalism, as it was called, was a big thing. And all of that sort of feeding this idea of the world as being kind of full of limitless potential, at least as it's kind of captured in stories from that time. I don't know if like and about that time. I don't know if that's like what it was actually like to live, you know, in the 1880s or something like that. But the difference between Against the Day and this is that Against the Day, there is some like, even though there's like wild flights of fancy and all these different ideas of what is possible and what might be real are followed, everything is sort of knit down to this texture of reality that is identifiable and has like continuity and you know, and has meaning and weight as a result. And the Vor, it's just, it feels like someone inviting us into a daydream that lasts for way too long.
Right.
The second read of this for me was so different from the first. Sure. The first was just so kind of like pleasant, where like, I guess like I just enjoyed, and the narrator's name is Alan Corduner. Good job, Alan. And the second time I had such a hard time, beyond really like, the first third. For the first third of the book, I was with it again. I was like, ooh, where's this going? And then,
well, a Cyclops has sex with his robot mother. Like, what's not to like?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, but it's really evident, like the Vor should be, when the Frenchman and Cylcor venture into the Vor in the train, I'm like, all right, Heart of Darkness shit. You know, here we go. Like, this is when we pierce the veil. But, you know, it was just so evident to me this time that Brian Catling doesn't know how to describe a jungle in wherever in Africa. And then it's like, where is this in Africa? And that matters. You know, that's extraordinarily important. Right. You know, and I had no sense other than like this vague idea of like shifting darkness and light. And he's playing with like details that like that aren't regionally important.
Right.
You know, like, oh, they fell asleep and they didn't wake up for a whole day. And then they woke up and then they were in the Vor. And it's like, this is sort of like how knights wrote about like strange distant lands that they visited, you know, with like, you know, giants that they did battle with, you know, when they're sitting around the table with the king and the king has never been anywhere and the king just believes everything that they tell him.
Right.
And there was something really disappointing about it. So thank you for reading it. But Hans, I guess like I did an unfair thing at the beginning because like I thought one of the things that you might like, you didn't mention the frame when we talked about it before, but you mentioned sort of the way it began and ended, and we meet Kinder and Kinder, and if you read a little bit about Roussel and Impressions of Africa, there's like little, I guess like while they kind of have like cult. They're a cult hit. There's little like in them in Impressions to Africa, from what I understand, that is actually sort of like there's no Roussel is not an authority on Africa. He just went there for a little while and came back and then wrote this like long fantastical piece that everyone hated upon returning. And Kinder, we meet Kinder, and he's also, you know, a prick. Like he basically names this he decides to call this person who has a name Cylcor, and he has all these preconceived notions. He has a lot of problems. And then are we given to understand that the text that we've just read is his? And is that like some sort of like is that like excusing how shallow it is? And then is this some sort of like sneaky, I don't believe any of this, what I'm just saying, like, and I kind of hate it, but like, is it like a writer technique for like, you know, this person also is ignorant as to like the details of Africa And this fictional character who actually wrote this book, this story that I am capturing in this book in my imagination. And it's like, don't blame me, blame Max. I don't know. I don't think that there's anywhere to take that.
That wouldn't make it enjoyable. That wouldn't have made it enjoyable for me, but it might have made it like some, like if he's like, okay, here, so I'm going to write a novel by pretending to be a racist writing about Africa, like an ignorant racist writing about Africa. Like that would be maybe interesting thematically, even if it wouldn't make it any more enjoyable to me. I don't know. But so like I'm going to write a novel about a guy who writes a novel about Africa. Is that, I don't know. It's interesting to think about, but I don't know where it goes, like you said.
Yeah. I think that it unmakes itself, and it's part of what makes me hate postmodernity. To think about like that being like a conscious choice for a writer to make.
Right.
Where like don't take anything that you're about to read seriously.
So you hated, what was that? What was that one thing we read in Forms of Fiction by Kazuo Ishiguro?
Oh, When We Were Orphans?
Yeah, When We Were Orphans.
No, I actually loved that one because that one it felt like delusions refracted through the mind of someone who is suffering terrible grief and loss. Where like we can't trust him because he's made insane by the estrangement from his parents.
So it's like the difference is that like you kind of know or understand. I don't know.
The story is, I don't know, like to me there was texture in the, and it's, I haven't read it since then. So, but like I loved that book for being about a mind that wasn't really accurately capturing the world around it. And that being, even though the world around the mind was the world around the mind was actually the imperfect lens for looking at the mind itself. We're getting this like very bizarre story about, I don't remember the main character's name, running around, post-war situation or in a chaotic situation looking for his parents who are long past and having very unbelievable experiences with other characters. And I don't know. I liked it, but you didn't like that one either?
I don't think I did. Maybe I'd like it if I reread it. I'm not sure.
Do you think that I liked the Vore when I read it the first time. Do you think if you read it, you didn't like it the first time. If you read it the second time, maybe you would like it.
Maybe. Like sometimes I think that happens. Like when my brother first introduced me to Clutch, I was like, ugh, this sucks. I hate this. And then I listened to it 10 years later and I was like, Clutch fucking rules. Clutch is great. And so,
maybe, so you're going to put this on your calendar. You'll put the Vore on your calendar to try again in 10 years.
Maybe like, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to put it on there, but I might read it again in 10 years. Who knows? Probably not. I won't like,
I don't think so. Hans, you've actually come to the defense of the book. I think that you're being very kind.
Yeah. I didn't like it,
but like,
I mean, I think that it, boy, yeah, you know, the first time that I read it, there's stuff you can enjoy about it at a sentence level, and maybe the more you think about that joy, the more it vanishes, right? But like, it can be enjoyable at a sentence level. It has interesting ideas here and there. I wasn't necessarily bored reading it the first time. I think the first time I to some extent, I just kind of figured, no, there's probably stuff here I'm missing, right? I probably read this too quickly. I didn't pay enough attention. Yeah. I'll come back in a few years. And I think coming back in a few years, it turned out there wasn't really anything I was missing, right? I think that I thought maybe like it was based on things that I didn't know. It was referencing things I didn't know. Maybe it was like, maybe everybody else that reads it understands that it's like really carefully researched evocation of like Zambia in 1921. And I was too ignorant to get that, you know. I thought maybe there were thematic things or symbolic things I was missing, right? Like the fact, I think when I read it the first time, the fact that the Thomas Muybridge thread never connects with any of the other threads, I thought was kind of daring and cool. And I figured it must be doing some like really rich symbolic thing with that thread, that where it interplayed in these symbolic thematic ways I wasn't quite getting. Rereading it, I think he just didn't bother, you know. There are things that I was able to attribute to my own laxity as a reader on a first read that, I don't know, maybe some Vore superfan is going to write us and go, actually, and, you know, explain all the great symbolism in the Thomas Muybridge thing that I'm missing, and explain all the, you know, the ways that it actually is a daring evisceration of colonial abuses in ways that I'm missing. I don't know, man. Right, but right. Yeah, I didn't like it. And there were even, boy, beyond all the stuff that we've talked about already that we didn't like, it just has a kind of nastiness sometimes that seems deeply pointless to me, mm-hmm. you know, like when the servant Mütter's son gets his hands cut off and sewn back on upside down. It's like
backwards. Yeah.
It's a little bit funny, but it just mostly seems just kind of mean and gross for the sake of it. Right. And it's.
Yeah.
That kind of thing just seemed, I mean, it's a very,
what?
I'm not necessarily opposed to things being vicious or cold hearted, but in the absence of any other redeeming qualities other than some pretty good sentence level writing, that bugged me too. Yeah. I didn't sure. really like it.
Yeah.
Sure.
There's a boy who gets shot in the head for just not being able to get out of the way of an assassin who wants to leave a bar.
Yeah.
But yeah,
I thought it was even worse. Like, he got his penis cut off.
Oh yeah, no, you're right. He shot him in the penis. He shot his penis off.
Like, for, like, and I'm like, why? Like, what? You know,
there's even some internality in the assassin's head. He's like, he felt he didn't really want to do it, but he didn't want to like be seen as weak, so he shoots this little boy's penis off.
Right. Yeah, like, I'm like, what?
Oh my god, why did I like this book?
Hey man, I liked a bunch of dumb shit when I was a dumb shithole, you know?
I liked this book recently, Patrick. Through a few years.
That was a joke.
Say, I am curious now, you know, we had mentioned before that this turned out to be a trilogy of sorts, and I don't have any idea how you would continue mm-hmm. any of these narratives, right? It does make me curious. I don't really want to read the other two, but I'm genuinely curious how you would extend this, right? Like, if it's totally different characters, if it's, I don't know, interestingly enough, I just looked the second book of the Vore trilogy up on Amazon, and in the products related to this item, number 3 is the Unabomber's Manifesto. Number 4 is Starcat trilogy. So interesting mix of stuff. All right, well,
my brother got me the Unabomber Manifesto for Christmas one year because I think he called himself an anarchist.
Did you actually read the Unabomber's Manifesto?
No, I never did.
I have not read it directly.
I don't
I read a I haven't read it directly. I read a an essay by Chuck Klosterman where he basically said, you know, it's a shame that this guy blew all these people up because he has some pretty good points. The only point that I remember him making, it's one of those things where I'm not sure how much of it was like actually Kaczynski and how much of it was Klosterman's gloss on Kaczynski that stuck in my head, right? But like, basically, the point of it, as Klosterman summarized it, is that like the luxury of living in a technological society distorts and narrows our experiences in ways that we don't even think about. And the example that Klosterman used was, if I tell you, imagine a basketball game, or if I tell you, imagine a tropical island, you don't freely imagine a basketball game or a tropical island, right? You imagine a TV broadcast of a tropical island or a basketball game, right? Mm-hmm. That the ways that we, that, you know, like, and yeah, I mean, pragmatically, who gives a fuck if you can freely imagine a basketball game or a tropical island, right? But like, our ways of thinking are so deeply shaped by mediation and technology in ways that for the most part we're completely unaware of, but that do in fact drastically restrict our range of thought and experience, right? And that is
right, and that is a good point.
That's true. You know, I don't know what to do about it ultimately. I mean, I like air conditioning, right?
Right. Right. I definitely want air conditioning 100%.
So anyway, any okay. I know you got to get out of here, Chris. Any last words about the Vor before I tell you guys my pick for next time?
Yeah, I do have. I have one last thing, Patrick. I pulled up pulling from the Wikipedia article about Raymond Roussel. I think that there's interesting if Kinder is taken as sort of like a potentially like a vehicle for the story, and Kinder's based on Roussel, and Roussel, you know, wrote Impressions of Africa, which feels like, you know, Catling must have read it and been thinking about it, you know, or thinking about it even as some kind of model. But like the Impressions of Africa was written according to formal constraints based on homonymic puns. And what he describes, Roussel in his own words, I can't understand at all. But it definitely sounds as though like he basically used the sort of random connectedness of language to make sort of like new sentences that don't mean anything out of like sentences that did mean something. He would choose two similar words, for example, billiard and pillared. Pillared is looter in French. Then I added to it words similar but taken in two different directions, and I obtained two almost identical sentences thus. The two sentences found, it was a question of writing a tale which can start with the first and finish by the second. Amplifying the process, then I sought new words reporting itself to the words billiards, always to take them in different directions than that which was presented first of all, and that provided me each time a creation moreover. This process moved, and I was led to an unspecified sentence, of which I drew from the images by dislocating it a little as if it had been a question of extracting some from the drawings of a rebus. So basically he's creating complete nonsense. Mm-hmm. Even though he did travel around the world, 10 years after he wrote Impressions of Africa. So he's a terrible, terrible source for writing about Africa. His whole purpose is to basically pick someplace really far away and then like come up with nonsense sentences about it. And that is what Impressions of Africa is.
Hmm. That's... Well, you know, I don't know what to say about that.
Yeah, Well, don't read the Vore.
Right. You know, I feel really bad for, like, the Vore enthusiasts who are going to click the link on this. Oh, fuck yeah, another Vore podcast, and we just unabashedly shit all over it. But for me, this feels really good. Like, I do not recall a podcast we've done before where I just shat all over it. And that was, this is great. I love this.
Probably
the Carpathians.
Yeah, the Carpathians. But the Vore deserves it.
I shat on it, but the
Vore deserves it.
The Vore deserves it. And I don't actually, like, the Carpathians, as much as I didn't like it, is at least, like, a real good novel, you know, like, as much as I didn't enjoy it. Okay, Hans,
with the Carpathians, you had a harder time articulating the reasons for your disdain, as I recall.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so I have not, this is actually another first, which is that I have never read the thing that I picked. So, but it's, the title of the book is Mona. The author is Pola Oloiharuk. I'll send that Mona to you guys by chat as well, because the author's name is, you can't really guess the spelling from the sounds that my mouth made just now, so.
Okay. Mona.
There's an X in there.
There is, yeah. But okay. I read a review of this and I thought, oh, that sounds like it would be right up my alley. And I went out and bought a copy and I have not cracked it yet. And I thought, well, I'll just bring the guys along on this journey.
How do you spell Mona?
M-O-N-A.
Like, oh, so Mona Lisa, not like Mona the Deftones song? M-O-A-N-A?
Exactly.
Moana?
Well, it's the Deftones song is pronounced Mona. Paula. What's the last name?
Oloiharuk.
Paula Oloiharuk?
O-L-O-I-X.
I won't bother the listeners with this bullshit.
It's a beautiful name. Just, how dare you?
Just send me the name in chat and I'll get it later. Okay. Cool. I hope everybody enjoyed our discussion of the Vore, and I hope everybody comes in next time when we discuss Mona. All right. Peace out, comrades.